Speaking of reliability, friends talking about reliability engineering topics. Let's discuss how to create and improve your reliability program and your career.
Hi, this is Adam Barrett.
And Chris Jackson.
Welcome to an edition of Speaking of Reliability. Today we have a topic that has to do with, effectively, at the end of the day, organizations that can get caught off guard by not being aware of the difference between evolutionary design and revolutionary design.
And so in that context, what is the difference between evolutionary design and revolutionary design?
So evolutionary design, I see, and we know a lot of products like this, they have a core technology they developed a long time ago. And mm-hmm. their design changes have been primarily very small and in response to seeing opportunities for improvement, either in field performance or, you know, just simply in testing or in their own use. And you can really look at any design change that was implemented was motivated by simply improving what existed. You're not mm-hmm. looking to add major features. You're not looking to make dramatic, you know, big changes to mitigate issues. It's a smaller, that's what we call it, an evolutionary process. It follows that. The revolutionary is when there's a, you know, you make a very big jump in a technology, in a feature, in a functionality. And that's a very different design process and program strategy.
So Waymo's just released, well, not released, but just first started using autonomous cars in a public scenario, as far as we're aware, for the very first time. I'm guessing that satisfies your definition of revolutionary design, these autonomous cars, which are now driving around in the suburbs of Arizona.
Yeah, absolutely. That's not the kind of, you know, that's not the same thing as designing a different type of wheel for a regular car. That's more, you just do the same testing program. It definitely right. requires these extensive testing programs. Those autonomous cars have been on the road for millions and millions and millions of miles of data and optimization improvement. And that's, you could not do anything less than that and feel you had a chance at having a successful product. So I think the importance of this, of highlighting this, is what I call the, well, it's one, I call a couple things a sideswipe, but this is definitely a sideswipe I can see happen to organizations. And I've been brought into organizations to help them where they've very wisely seen that this is going to happen. You can have a product development program and tools and style and organization that is very much based around the evolutionary type of product development process. And a lot of times what happens is there's a core technology that they invented decades ago, 30 years ago, and they really took the market by storm and became a leader and kind of have been able to, you know, hold a great market share by, you know, with pretty much the same core technology and just making lots of evolutionary changes, smaller changes to the product, not looking to add, you know, huge features or anything like that. And a lot of it is in response to observations of performance in the field. Okay, this could be better, that could be better. We got this feedback, a customer want, that kind of thing. Now, that's all good and fine until they find either through just ambition or realizing a necessity to add a major feature or make a dramatic change. And this happens a lot now in current time because so many products that didn't have very advanced electronics now do. I mean, your coffee maker now connects to your Wi-Fi, right? And mm-hmm. coffee maker manufacturers historically, that's not something that, you know, they did. They do a lot of small iterative, you know, evolutionary changes. So now you may find that your organization is not capable of revolutionary type change, right? The team that came up with a different wheel for the tire is not the same team that can make an autonomous vehicle. That's such a big jump. Very different strategy, different program, different tools entirely.
Mm-hmm. So, and I'm guessing that just to give an example of the evolutionary design, most vehicles are essentially, so look at the Toyota Highlander, for example. That's not a revolutionary vehicle. That is a vehicle which is each year the model is 98% common with previous year's model, even though some of the things make it really more enjoyable to drive and you might pay more money for a new Toyota Highlander. it's not evolutionary, even if it's got a new navigation system or the cup holders are warm or something that some people might think is revolutionary. It's in fact, it's just a refining of an existing technology to make the customer happier.
Right. Now, if that same team then all of a sudden they took them and said, hey, guys, do you know what? Next year, we're going to make a hybrid one. That's not an evolutionary thing. You know, that same team doing the same techniques they've done year after year for the previous mm-hmm. models, if they applied their same schedule, tactics, and tools to making a hybrid one, mm-hmm. it would be a disaster.
Well, and even then, I suppose it's a continuum as well. The hybrid cars still borrow a lot of the mechanics from the non-hybrid cars. So there can be a little bit of a continuum between what is evolutionary and what is revolutionary. But I take your point. There are some things which are clearly not what they used to be.
Yeah. Yeah. It would be, I mean, the point I would, exactly, there's a big gray sliding scale, a big, you know, a gray area sliding scale of those two. There is not a clear delimiting line. But if you took, you know, if you look at a lot of traditional automotive manufacturers, I mean, they're broken down in these very small groups. I mean, there's the group that does the dashboards. There's a group that does mm-hmm. the combustion motors. So throwing in something like the, you know, electric drivetrain controllers, control system, and having it work with the gas system and all that, that kind of, though this is an example of how the, not just the tools, but the organization has to be different, is that interactions between electromechanical have just gone way up. And those interactions are where a lot of failures are going to happen. So you now need to have an organization and process that puts a lot of weight on understanding and, you know, and directing what happens there.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, historically, the electrical mechanical teams, right? It's like the electrical team interacts with the engine team by what do you want the wiring harness to look like? Where now it's a control system that affects when the motor runs, you know, and how the motor runs, and the motor outputs affect what it decides to do, and which affects the transmission, which affects the switch over to the electrical system.
Absolutely. We're still coming to terms with this. I mean, we're in the aviation industry. The whole idea of flying by wire was, and still is, fundamentally different to previous technologies that we were more comfortable with, because human beings tend to be very mechanically minded. We don't like electrons passing through cables controlling things that could potentially kill us in many cases. So for your advice for the difference between, so how do we need to treat the product development process differently if it's evolutionary versus revolutionary?
Well, I don't think there's any just clean-cut textbook answer. I think the key is here, the difference between failure and success is when you become aware that this is a situation you're in. I think it's really mm-hmm. that simple. On one end of the scale, your awareness happens when your product fails horrendously in the field. You become very painfully aware very quickly that, oops, you know, we didn't do this right. And if you do good analysis of what happened, you may find, wow, it was the way we did the design. We did it the way we've always done it, but that doesn't work when you include, you know, high-tech features for the first time. On the other end of the scale, where you hope to be, is to be self-aware enough to have listened to Adam and Chris on their podcast say, to say, you know, and you recognized yourself. You said, wait a minute, we invented this technology in 1960. We've pretty much been making the same thing ever since. We've really only made changes to improve the existing design. But now for the first time, you know, we're going to switch everything over from metal to plastic, and we're going to include a control system, and it's going to go to Wi-Fi, and people can control it on an app on their phone. And be like, well, okay, wait a minute, our process is not going to work. And before you take on that new design iteration, you stop and look at the organization that's going to be supporting that program and figure out how it needs to change. That to me is the important part, is that at what moment in time you become aware.
And I was just thinking about scenarios where it's not neither one of those two you just spoke about. They're actually design processes which should be evolutionary, but are treated as if they're revolutionary. And what I mean by that, you and I have both seen organizations which routinely build or produce the same thing over and over again. They have, every couple of year or couple of years, they need to build the next model, which, yes, while it needs to do more things, is still a variation of the previous model. But when it comes time to go and see or learn or look into the history of the previous model development process, there's either A, no information, or B, culturally there's no motivation to do that for whatever reason. So we see these things quite literally having their wheels reinvented, even though they built one which is very, very similar a couple of years ago, and they create this what should be an evolutionary product as if it is revolutionary because they've forgotten where they came from.
Yeah, that's very sad to see, because the information they need's in front of them. They're just not recording it and looking at it. And how could you possibly have any kind of good financial margins if you aren't reusing, you know, the processes and knowledge that you have, right? I mean, that's IP, right? And,
exactly.
You know, and that's where your strength is. So, yeah, with that kind of a thing, that's like very remedial. If you're reinventing the same thing over and over again every time, I'm kind of just really surprised you're in business. Because talk about an easy win for somebody to come and take you out, right? It's to, because they can do it with great efficiency, not to mention growth. How can you grow if you're not basing it on the previous, you know, design, right? And, you know, like all your effort goes to recreating it rather than advancing it. So, that's pretty, that's definitely at one end of the spectrum.
And I suppose the other thing that comes from that is that, how can you say our company or organization stands for anything? You can't. Your reputation, even though you might invest a bit of time in a bit of resources into saying, yes, we are good at what we do, at the end of the day, you have no corporate history. If you keep reinventing the wheel each time, your company almost stands for nothing, because you're not basing what you do now based on what you've done in the past. And that's just, you said it was sad. I completely agree. It's just almost commercial suicide.
Yeah. I guess I'm trying to picture a scenario where that, you know, could, where it's most likely to happen. And I can picture startups actually doing that, you know, because they're in such a starved state of resource. You know, every individual person has three different roles, and there's such a desperation to hit specific deadlines. It's obviously things like recording things for prosperity don't make it high on the priority list every day when you're already doing three different roles. And I think that probably part of them going from being a startup organization to a more mature organization is beginning to allocate resource to that task, because you won't sustain or last. You know, you can break into the market with a new technology and you will gain market share because you brought a new technology to market. But once it's not as new and there's potential competitors and, you're not going to be able to sustain with that Wild West kind of just only going forward. You can't be efficient.
One type of organization I've seen this reinventing the wheel as a particular problem for is those companies that deal with typically governmental customers in a relatively ad hoc basis, but where those customers tend to provide quite detailed performance requirements. And what that means for a workforce is that you have a workforce established for product A. We've got requirements. Oh, we solved that problem. We created this thing. We sell it back to that customer who's happy, hopefully happy with the device. But you don't actually know when that first customer is going to come back to you and say, we want the next model. And when that happens, you have this very, let's call it, transactional approach to design and build. That is, company A paid for it up front. Customer A paid for it up front way back when. We did it. We finished that body of work. Now we need to wait for the next body of work with its own requirements and forget that what we are doing is still essentially creating the same product. It's just evolved over time. But we reinvent the wheel because we, amongst other things, we potentially fired or lost the workforce that produced it back in 5 years ago. I see it very prevalent in those organizations whose customers are typically governmental and in an ad hoc way provide customer requirements, which can be quite detailed. I'm not sure if this is your experience, but I think it's a sense that you have a lot of experience in startups more so than these guys.
And I guess, too, I kind of see that as one of the costs of that style of business, right? With, you know, you have with governmental, the way that they structure it, there are certain efficiencies to how they structure it, but there's definitely inefficiencies. And I think that's one of them. And they would have to, I guess you'd have to really sit down and break down what the reasons are for why it's structured that way. To see if it would be worth changing it to gain the increased efficiency of, you know, retaining knowledge across programs. But that's interesting. I mean, yeah, because government programs are – government's such an unusual customer. I've worked on different programs where, you know, it was solely a product being developed, you know, for the Marines or for something else. And that is a very unique customer that there's no other like it that exists with regard to what the requirements become on the program and the, you know, the objectives and the way it's approached.
And I've seen it in the space in this industry too. You look at a lot of satellites, for example, they have customers in the manufacturers have customers in mind, and these customers have thousands upon thousands of requirements. And to an extent, you have to design a satellite from scratch if it's fundamentally different from the previous one. Not all satellites are the same, but there are certainly scenarios where you need to make a commercial decision about whether you're going to be building this sort of thing in the future. And if so, you're going to slash your margin. You're going to increase your profit margin substantially if you're able to take as much information as you can out from the learning process you inevitably go through when you design something from scratch for the first time.
Yeah, but I mean, isn't that what SpaceX has just leveraged, that gap where historically rocket programs have been exactly in this format you're talking about with, you know, government contractors, you know, governments contracting specific people, whereas SpaceX, you know, developed rockets with no customer driving it. They just were driving it as a product development program. And, you know, in looking to optimize things like cost point, and they ended up making, you know, rockets that I believe operate at 1/4 the cost of what, you know, similar designs are that are done in the traditional methods. And looking to this whole idea of reusable, not only making iterative designs, scalable designs, you know, they're all scaled on the same, you know, basic platform, but they're individually reusable, you know, and can be restored and reused again quickly. So kind of what we're talking about, there's this, you know, there's companies that have actually leveraged the fact that, hey, this technology, which really kind of required the kind of like government defense funding to come into existence. I mean, things like the moon landings and rocket programs really weren't, there really wasn't going to be a startup company in the 60s that pulled that off. There just isn't profitability for it. But now that it is a technology that's very tied into everything we do, exactly, you can leverage the fact that the inefficiencies of that.
Well, if we want to talk about the SpaceX example, what they're doing now, those rockets, they actually rival a rocket which is currently being, a rocket system, perhaps more correctly, which is being developed by NASA right now, which is a space launch system. And that space launch system has attracted a huge amount of criticism because I think that statistic you were quoting where the SpaceX rockets cost about 1/4 of their competitors, I think that's based on the anticipated space launch system launch costs. And for those who aren't familiar with the Space Launch System, or the SLS for short, it's being developed by consortium involving NASA, but it's that traditional, let's go and design rockets the way we've always designed rockets. And amongst the potential cost blowouts, the schedule is also heavily delayed. The first launch is not planned until 2020, which was delayed many, many years after. But that figure represents a substantial delay from what was originally planned. And it's very, very expensive, and it's perhaps is not doing the things that SpaceX is already doing right now. So there could be something to that example. Look, what is so fundamentally different about these two different programs? I know we're moving away from a strict conversation on reliability, but we have a new, perhaps more agile approach versus the old traditional approach, and there is a stark difference.
Yeah, and so I think what is different, and that will allow us to see, you know, really how this will unfold, is if NASA is doing it because they're also the customer, you know, then they'll be able to have this program progress along, which historically they kind of were. But if it's a company that, let's say, you know, Comcast, that wants to put up a satellite, that's a business, and, you know, SpaceX and NASA and, you know, the other SLS program both bid to put the satellite up in space, and they both put it in the same spot in space, and one's a quarter the cost of the other, the SLS program just will be canceled at some point when that becomes evident. And mm-hmm. and that'll be the transition. So it would have to be something special about the SLS, has to provide something, whether it's a level of control or secrecy or special features that are to be used by NASA, I would say, or, you know, a customer that's being designed and built for that to survive. Because, mm-hmm. yeah, if it's the same, the SpaceX rocket, it's here today and it costs a quarter of what the other one does.
Perhaps there's some previously hidden characteristic of the space launch system that we're going to learn about, but it is attracting a lot of criticism because of all those things we just spoke about. So what can we learn from this approach to evolutionary versus revolutionary design process of these different rockets? Is there anything to be learned? I think there is.
Oh, I think it'll be interesting to watch this transition continue to see if it does, as it already, the projection already seems to be that this idea of a reusable rocket and made by a private company, you know, being sold or even just, you know, the space leased to other private companies, there's no way the other version will work. So I think the story will tell itself in that situation. That's good. Wow, what a good conversation. That was interesting. We covered a lot of dynamics of it.
Well, again, this is all about us. As a rule, we try and talk about something which we think is going to be quite specific, but we just find these little rabbit warrens. And a lot of the things we talk about, Adam, I would argue, are not just reliability centric. It's good design process centric. It's good manufacturing process centric. It seems to be a common thread.
It's definitely interesting. I hope it's interesting to our listeners too, and I hope they comment on this. We love to see comments and feedback, and have this be a back and forth relationship, because it also gives us ideas on other topics to talk about. So thank you to everybody for listening, and we look forward to seeing your comments. Thanks for talking, Chris.
Thanks, Adam. Thanks for taking the time to talk to me.
All right. Take care. Bye.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation. If you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show, please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.